All right. Thank you, everybody, for coming up here today to listen to the presentation. One of the things I'd like to do is get to know the audience a little bit better to just kind of see where the group's coming from in terms of your perspective. It'll help me as I go through the presentation. So how many of you are entrepreneurs in here by show of hands? So, okay, some entrepreneurs. How about any VC or investment type folks in here? Okay. How about higher ed? Education, okay. Now, of that group, so keep those hands up, how many are teaching? Okay, and then those teachers, if you can bring that down, how many are in higher ed with, like, the marketing side of it or the branding side? Okay, so, all right, that really helps. Thank you. I'll try to adjust accordingly to the audience, and there'll be time for the questions. And I would like to say, I think we're a small enough group, too, that, you know, there's probably plenty of time for interruptibility in here. And I apologize. Normally, I would have a mic, and I could move a little bit, but this is on a cord, so I can't get too far. So I usually don't like to stand behind a podium. My name's Bill Ward. I teach social media at the Newhouse School at Syracuse University. And the hashtag for this is SX Newhouse, if you're using Twitter, which I hope you are, to you know, follow along and take notes. SX Newhouse. So one of the things, because I don't know many of you, I just wanted to share a little bit of my background because I think it's important for understanding me and my perspective to social media beyond the, you know, where do you push the button and how do you do that type thing. So the keep digging for worms, if you look at my blog, I end every blog post with that. And when I was younger, I was fortunate. I grew up on a lake, and my dad taught me to fish and how to catch worms and go out and do that. And he drank Maxwell House coffee, so I always had the empty cans to put the worms in when I was out there. We call them night crawlers up north. I don't know how you all do it down here. But, you know, one of the things about that as a kid, you know, my parents were very encouraging and they said, yeah, you should do that. Have a worm business, sell night crawlers, you know, cause I was thinking about that. So I went up to the library back then. That's how we got our information. We went to the library. I got out books on raising worms and growing worms. I got fishing catalogs and looked at the back and ordered, like, there was one on African night crawlers and this special thing. And I ordered a special soil from one of the catalogs that was supposed to be really good to grow the worms and feed the worms. And I had to put that soil into, you know, into the dirt and mix it in by hand. And you had to keep it damp and in a cool place. So we had a cellar at our house where I had that. And so, you know, that's how I got in the business. And I put up a little sign for people to come in and buy their night crawlers. And as they came in, I would ask them how the fishing was and where they were going, you know, to catch the fish, what kind of fish they were using, what type of lures. A Texas rig was one of the most popular ones up in Michigan. I'm not sure why. But I just wanted to share that story because, to me, this digging for worms is really what social learning is about. These tools that we have available to us on these mostly free platforms allow us to do a lot of, you know, self-learning. And so I wanted to share that story so you at least have that understanding about, you know, my background and why that is. Another thing that people ask is, and it's sort of funny, it's like, well, what's with the avatar and why aren't you wearing a tuxedo and a bow tie here today? And a little story on that, again, to help you get to know me. So some people say, what, you know, is that supposed to be James Bond? And I'm like, well, no, I'm definitely not that cool, and are you sure we'd all like to be? But one of my first jobs, you know, I call it my real job, my non-entrepreneurial job, was working for a chain of retail super centers called Meijer, grocery stores, kind of like a Walmart super center up in the Midwest. And back then, we had to wear ties to work to bag groceries and shag carts, go out in the parking lot and pull all the carts back. We also had a drive-up area where we had to put the cars and the groceries when people pulled up. And I was always worried that I was going to shut my tie into the trunk of the car. So I started wearing bow ties in high school because I didn't want to get my tie stuck into the back of the car and get dragged down, you know, the street behind the car. And so that's just some little tidbits, but I wanted to give that perspective because it kind of might give you an idea of my approach to social media and how I've used it. The other thing that might come up, and you guys have probably encountered this, is, you know, have you ever Googled yourself? How many people have Googled their name, Googled themselves? Okay, well, this is a little quiz here. We'll see how good you guys are. Who can tell me the name of this band? All right. Black Sabbath. What's the name of the drummer of Black Sabbath? Anybody know? Obscure question. His name's Bill Ward, which is my name. So when I Googled, this is what came up. You know, parental advisory, Ozzy Osbourne, lead singer. I mean, classic band. I'm like, oh, no, it's going to be really tough having an identity online as Bill Ward. The other Bill Ward was a pinup artist who did these risque, naughty pinup girls from World War II. And I was like, yikes, you know, that's not really what, you know, where I'm at, too. So the Dr. Ford kind of came out of that evolution of you know, trying to get into that online space and learn these tools. And so that's a little story there. So the Dr. Forward is part of my last name, but it's also the forward part is my idea of trying to look ahead and figure out what's next, what's coming next. And eventually, going to school long enough, I did my doctorate at Michigan State in media and information studies. And eventually, you know, I was able to get those credentials. So moving on, and again, I'm giving you that a little bit so you understand me personally and kind of my perspective on this. If we teach today as we taught yesterday, we rob our children of tomorrow. John Dewey, a philosopher and education reformer. I think that really captures it. And my goal today isn't to sell you on social learning or social media. I think Southwest. EDU has been, you know, fighting that fight here previous to this event. So my job is to really explain to you some of the innovative things that we're doing in terms of partnerships with higher education and industry, which is why I wish the VC panel that was here before that was, you know, talking about that was still here, because I'm hoping that, they'll hear about some of these things and kind of understand that a lot of these opportunities are free to you guys and available. So I'm hoping I'm stimulating some ideas on how you can do some of these things for your own, particularly those in your higher ed space and for your own benefit, and also for the entrepreneurs and startups in here. Here's some ideas on how you might be able to approach higher ed to take advantage of some of these things. So one of the fundamentals of this conversation here that if you agree with this, that there's a social revolution and that it is transforming things, then that fundamentally changes the discussion. If your goal is to make the case that that's happening, I think that's, you know, another debate that's going on. And you know, the people that are working hard to change those cultures and address that resistance to that change. So my perspective is there has been a revolution, that it's happening, and it's, you know, beyond the tipping point in terms of its impact, and so I'm going to kind of try to move on from there in terms of our discussion here. So I'm not trying to sell you on, you know, using social media. I'll just explain what we're doing with it. I hope that makes sense for what you guys are here for. One of the questions I had, do you guys remember where you were when you first discovered this transformative effect of technology or social media, whether that's Twitter? Yeah, where were you at? Can you... Right, great example. And yeah, email and now, of course, social certainly accelerates and amplifies those kind of conversations in terms of who can participate. As you're thinking about that question, I actually, you know, there's a couple events, and I wanted to share this because I think it also will give you my perspective on social media, which might be more, I'm pretty sure it is more pragmatic than academic. I'm not a traditional academic. I worked my way through school, went nights, and stuck around long enough. Eventually, I got, you know, some of these other credentials. I think what really changed it for me, I was teaching at Alfred University, a small private school in New York, and I took students on a study abroad program, and I helped them get a scholarship, and part of the requirement of the scholarship was that they had to keep in touch with the funders of the scholarship to let them know what they were doing on the study abroad. And they wanted to hear about it on, you know, through the blog. This was in 2007. So I had to learn blogging to help the students learn blogging so that they could earn, you know, their scholarship. One of the benefits of that blogging, we were also able to connect with a lot of alum back to the university. They were incorporating their marketing. So it really had a lot of communication advantages. The family could follow along. Most of you have had certainly a similar experience and that type of you know, advanced technology. So it was always a practical result for me. It was never a debate of does this work or not. I saw very clearly that it was a communication tool, a collaboration tool, information sharing. And I was able to do it. And, you know, my first experience was a global one. I was like, wow, this is fantastic. We were going to the Cannes Lions, at that time it was the International Advertising Festival. We met a lot of great people who we were then able to stay in contact with through all of this technology. Those people then came and either visited personally or via video conference, then spoke to my classes. So the people I met from all over the world now entered in my classroom. So, you know, some of this debate's always been a challenging one for me. I get frustrated because those results seemed self-evident to me in my experience of what it was doing for the students' learning and my own. Then next year, which is 2008, we had to figure out a way how to communicate with a group. We were at a conference, you know, the Cannes Lions is similar to this in that there's all these great things going on. You know, you want to be at five different places at once. And myself and the students actually were, but we were live tweeting. And so I could see what they were doing and learn a little bit from them. They could see what I was doing. Again, it seems like old hat here now, but back then it was kind of a newer thing. So that really, I guess, you know, kind of formulated my experience with it. And so I guess I wanted you to think about that a little bit as we go forward. So this is a hopefully that yeah that shows up. This is the recent Society of Digital Agencies report. And the question was asked, are you seeing a trend toward clients evolving, transforming their marketing organization structure, you know, fundamentally changing the structure of business? And 73% of these in this survey, over 600 of agencies, brand marketers, et cetera, said that there was a fundamental transformation going on, that they're seeing that with their clients. So if we're seeing that level out in the business world and in industry, is that reflected back in higher ed and K through 12 if we have those folks here as well? And I don't think that kind of transformation is happening at that kind of pace. And so I don't think we're keeping up. I compare it, I'm using a little out of context, but you might have heard this example. Education is one of these, and what's going on outside of education is the other one. And which one are we preparing the students for? What world will they be entering? Where are the economic and job opportunities? And so, you know, I think we need to do more for our transforming. And again, I'll share some of the examples of what I think qualify for that transformation. Some of you may know some of these groups or some of these folks in terms of their reform education philosophies. This is Sir Ken Robinson. You maybe heard him from TEDx and TED conferences. They've spent 10 years at school being told there's one answer. It's at the back and don't look and don't copy because that's cheating. And it says outside school, that's called collaboration, right? The stuff that we're doing in, you know, as entrepreneurs and startups, we're looking at best practice and we're building from that. And that's not necessarily what we're training or teaching students to do. In fact, we sometimes are penalizing them for that. Another source that might be familiar to you guys, again, is Clay Shirky. So either the idea is that all this new technology, either, you know, we're all watching cat videos and getting really, really dumb, or there's actually a cognitive surplus. We're actually collectively getting more intelligent, smarter, accelerating, learning more quickly, trying out what works and fails, and those kind of experiments. That acceleration, Clay Shirky certainly is saying that, you know, we have a cognitive surplus. That's what the advantages of this are. And he also looks at, are institutions obstacles or are they enabling collaboration in terms of how they're organized? And I don't know how your different higher ed institutions or organizations are, but I can tell you there's still quite a few silos in there, even though everybody will talk about collaboration. Kind of looks like this in that model. Is that, you know, you have all this information and ideas out there. The institutional response is to put it in neat little packets and organize it and then impose that structure on it. And then today with the technology, it's much more multi-directional and dynamic than that. And so that's another sort of case that I think is important here as I share these examples. This is another way of looking at it from a siloed standpoint. This is a graph from Edelman Digital that they use about, you know, closed versus collaborative, where those silos start to break down into more of an open model where very much more multilateral, directional. So that would be another aspect of that. You might have also, you're probably all familiar with Chris Anderson, from the TED conferences about this idea of organizations embracing radical openness. Again, I think that's a place that higher ed needs to be moving towards in terms of how they're engaging with their students and how they're engaging in the classroom. One of the things that's enabled by all this technology is this idea of accelerated innovation. We learn much more together as a group than we do individually as we share our ideas, find out what works and doesn't, and move that forward. And in fact, you know, we can learn from the finest every day, where before we were restricted by geography or you know, whatever happened inside the rooms of a classroom. And when you open that up, when you use some of these social learning and social media technologies to bring that in, you can find out basically that, you know, that world can reach back into the room in real time, actually, when you're using it. Timothy Gowers is a mathematician. He's a Fields Award winner, which is, I guess, the equivalent of the Nobel Peace Prize in mathematics. They did a collaborative research project that some of you may have heard of, and he described that collaborative process using these technologies as comparing normal research as driving is to pushing a car. So I think there's still a lot of car pushing going on that, you know, again, I think in this crowd that we would, you know, we've seen that and we're trying to, you know, progress from there. So again, some of this thinking, I'm not trying to explain or provide all the data support for that, but hopefully you understand where my, you know, philosophies are on this. One of the problems with this acceleration that's going on in this digital and social space is it's creating a digital divide, not of access to technology, but of people who know how to use it and harness it and people who don't. So I'll share a little bit of data with you as well about that. So, you know, one of the things that I have to do this with students too is try to make a case like, you know, students enjoy social media for their own relationships with their friends and their family, but they maybe haven't necessarily used it as a professional learning network or a tool for social learning to, you know, acquire a lot of new information and knowledge and share and or collaborate with people on that. So I think this is important, again, for you know, philosophically, maybe understanding where I come from. This was from September. 4 unemployed people for every 1 job opening. Pretty bleak statistic on the job market that's out there today. And but at the same time, the social media jobs are up 75%. And so I teach social media, so that's important to me because I'm preparing students specifically for those jobs. But a lot of the students that I have journalism students, advertising, public relations, media, all kinds of different majors. And they're like, well, I don't want to work in social media. And that's okay. But the other thing that you need to know that every month there's 10,000 jobs that have digital and social media skills in the job description. So, you know, it's at the point of if you want to work at Best Buy, maybe even want to work just in retail, they still expect you to be able to access the corporate blog and do some blogging yourself or understand how to use Twitter or some of these other things. So these skills are becoming very much a job entry requirement, not a, you know, something for just a social media expert to learn. So I think that's something that is important in this conversation too. I also, again, coming kind of from the communications and marketing perspective, which again may be different than other disciplines, you know, if you follow the money on where the spend is going, the growth in digital and social media is going to be continuing to increase this year and over the next 5 years. So those job opportunities will continue to evolve and become available in that space. At the same time, so you, unemployment doesn't look good, but in the digital and social space, it looks very good. But what about the employers? Well, 52% of those companies report difficulty filling jobs. So they've got the positions, but they don't have qualified people to fill them. So there, you know, in lies a part of the challenge. 47% of the employers blame their prospective's lack of hard skills or technical experience in getting those job opportunities. So many of these positions are going unfilled. 35% of employers cite candidates' lack of experience as well in that, in terms of these tools and applications. So big gaps there in terms of what companies need, what businesses need, what entrepreneurs and startups need, and what students are coming out with and being prepared for. Now, at the same time, you know, higher ed and K through 12 gets a lot of criticism. But interestingly enough, industry does a really poor job of training their own employees and retaining them. So this was a study from I'm not sure if the next study will be coming out any minute, but it was from March, where 90% of employees say that they have to figure things out on their own and receive no training. Well, at the same time, 50% of talent feel under-trained with no definable career path. So, you know, a lot of people are going in, especially college students. That's, you know, a population that many of us work with and I'm familiar with is, you know, I hear often from the employers that say, what's going on? I'm getting college students in. They're not prepared to do my work. And, you know, the expectation is there that they have all these digital and social skills. I spoke to a group of 200 plus teachers in Michigan, K through 12, and I thought I was going to hear all this great stuff that they're doing on digital and social with their students, and they weren't doing any of that. And I was actually thinking that when I was getting them as college freshmen and students, I'm thinking, oh, great, they're going to have this. They were getting zero. And so I thought, wow. So, you know, that expectation of the digital native and they're good with all this stuff. They're good at, you know, sharing with friends and communicating with family, but not in terms of the skills that employers might be looking for. So the gap is they're not necessarily getting the skill set in the education system. Industry isn't necessarily doing a good job of delivering it. And so that's where I think the next opportunity of digital and social learning will be these innovative partnerships with industry and higher ed. So I think that's encouraging for the entrepreneurs and the startups in here. And I think it's an exciting time. And I'll share some examples, specific ones, with you in terms of ones that we're doing at Newhouse in Syracuse. Again, hopefully to give you give ideas to you about how you might do that with your own startup or venture, or how you might do it for your own university and partnering with industry. So these things that I'm talking about don't have to cost a lot of money and in fact can generate revenue for the university if done, you know, correctly. One other thing, I know some of these other panels, I don't know if you caught some of the earlier ones, so if you missed the one before, I just want to talk about a little bit because, there's idea about higher ed, and it's certainly, you know, the aspiration of it is wonderful, but the reality is somewhat less than that. So I just want to touch on this a little in terms of this idea. So a lot of people want to go to college, but in reality, many people aren't getting that opportunity. Less than 1 in 17 children from families who earn less than 35 a year will earn a bachelor's degree. So I'm concerned about that. At Syracuse, we're a private university, well-known brand. We have a pretty good basketball team as well this year. And, you know, so there's that a lot of tension. So we get, you know, a pretty dynamic student population. But many universities, in terms of community colleges and other state universities, certainly have much more struggle. And I'll show you what those numbers look like. And again, some of this I'm hoping is familiar to you and you're, you know, being reminded of that. Some of these are problems that are much more systemic in terms of our education systems and how that's set up. 1 in 2 children from families who earn more than 85 a year will earn a degree, so there's still a disparity there. 30% of college students will drop out before their second year, so we're having a retention problem. Again, 50% of college students never graduate. Very alarming fact there when you think of the debt that's incurred in this process. Again, the community college, a lot of it in terms of some of these fundamental skills, it's like, well, the community colleges are growing at the seams as the unemployed have been going back there to get some training, and they're not necessarily getting the results either. So there's a challenge for higher ed. And again, my case that I'll be making is that I think industry can help higher ed in terms of delivering some of these skill sets. Just to break it down a little further, so non-selective, you know, basically colleges that will take kind of all comers or have very low standards. Their graduation rates are 35%. Selective competitive schools, which kind of fall in that category of Syracuse, where I'm at right now, 88%. And if you get to Harvard, you got a pretty good shot at graduating. So, you know, some of that is, you know, sort of built in the system of how higher ed is being delivered. So again, I'm certainly not suggesting that you know higher ed is going to be replaced by any of this, but I think the strength will be these partnerships between industry and higher ed that are the future. And that's where I've really shifted, and so I wanted to share that with you. So how will we bridge the talent and training crisis that is out there and make sure that our students are being prepared for the jobs of the future? So where do we start? And I love this quote. So in order to do good, you first have to do something. And I think sometimes higher ed has trouble getting started there. They're not necessarily the fastest movers. And that's where an opportunity is to become more nimble and innovative and try to move at a more quicker pace to try some of the things. It's okay if you try them and they don't work every time. And that's another thing that we sort of have to get past in terms of that. So in terms of social learning and entrepreneurship in this space, you know, these tools that we're looking at, and I'll show you several examples of the tools that we're using and tell you, and again, we'll have time for questions if you want to know detail and what we're doing with any of these, I'll share them with you. They're really just these things that enable students to build professional learning networks, to connect information, to actually do things. So I don't want to confuse these tools and tactics with, you know, the overall value and benefits of that. This was some the same report that SOTA report from this year, just released, I think, a week ago even. These were the top things that companies were looking for in terms of these specialized areas around digital and social. This understanding of strategy, social media monitoring, analytics, metrics, ROI, those are all important. Social response management, application development. We'll talk about that because some of the industry partnerships and skill sets that are needed are you know, pretty important to the future. So those are really at that first level is making sure that students have an understanding of, you know, these high strategic things. And then these are the tools and tactics that are helping deliver these. So I actually disagree with the group that was here before. They said, gee, there's no scalable solution or platform out there to deliver education. I'm like, it's not a problem of you know, having them be available. There's actually tons of them. It's what we do with them. And so, and most of them are available for free. So I'm not sure where the procurement issue comes in on some of this stuff. I think some of it is more importantly about a culture shift. And again, I'm not here to fight the culture shift. I'm going to imagine that you've move beyond that, and which I've been fortunate at Syracuse in terms of my position as a social media professor and what you can do after you move beyond that. I can explain what we're doing with all of these tools, but as a summary, working with the students, they're incorporating all of these into the learning experience. They're developing professional learning networks. They're learning how to do analytics around all these tools. They're learning content management and curation strategies. They're learning search engine optimization and other type of techniques to help, you know, get messages out and share information and connect with other people. They're using it as collaboration tools and creation tools and, you know, again, dynamic network communication tools. So all these tools are kind of in that toolkit. And again, you could debate any specific one of these tools. Is this one a trend right now? Is it going to go or not? But the concepts themselves are actually more important. So the tool may change. You know, I think I just heard a rumor that CNN might buy Mashable or some big change like that. Some of these, you know, Google could buy Twitter and that might change things. Or one of these companies may go out of business and not be sustainable. I think that's okay. I don't think that means that we shouldn't try them or learn them or incorporate them in. So, you know, at that standpoint, we have all these enabled. We use them in the classroom. All of the students are incorporated that. We have everything from live Twitter hashtags to Google Hangouts with, you know, interactive video conferencing, both for speakers, student team projects, and collaborations. We're using several content of these are content curation tools. All of these are enabled in terms of what the students are doing. And again, I could, if you have specific questions, I'd be happy to talk about that. But what I really wanted to talk about is where I see the this next level. Once you get to this level and you want to move on from here in terms of, okay, these are important concepts, these are important tools to engage with and use for learning, and are important to industry and future economic opportunity. If those are all things that you agree to, then where do we go after that? And so one of that next level, if you look at these, just Twitter, YouTube, Facebook, and Google Plus last year alone had more than 35 major platform changes. So think about that. Almost weekly, all these things are changing. You know, they're changing where the buttons are. They're changing. They're adding a new feature, and sometimes during the same week. In October, you know, Google Plus launched, and Facebook Timeline came out, and Spotify, a music sharing one. All these things were, you know, people were all, you know, there's a lot of sort of change and acceleration going on. But so, how do you keep up on that? And I don't know, does anybody else ever feel overwhelmed on trying to keep up with all this stuff? Some of you do? Good. I sure do. But one of the things that's really great is as you teach students about these tools and how to use them, they are actually responsible for bringing content into the classroom, for keeping up on these issues. So we use them to feed back into our own learning network. So the students are bringing new ideas, new information into the class that I alone would never be able to keep up on, or, you know, even other people who might be some of your filters. And then we're also able to use it to engage directly with industry, who then now enters into conversation. So you can talk to, you know, journalists directly. You can talk to chief marketing officers or people at the public relations or advertising agencies, or, again, depending on what other academic interests that might be specific, you could talk to experts in the field. Part of this just is a little, you know, this idea that students learn by doing. So all of these tools are stuff that they do. So they call it the flip model. Some people refer to it where the idea that the students are doing some self-learning on their own. And when they come into class, we're actually working on these tools and using these incorporated into it. And so, you know, the retention and the skills level and all that, you actually can see that, you know, measure, do they actually know this stuff or not? It's very visible to companies who are going to hire them. They'll see that. And, companies are very interested in this as they see students get these skill sets. Some of them even get hired directly out of classes. So, here's a couple, things that I just want to talk about in terms of these future. This is to me where I see this next, you know, generation of where education is going. So one of the things that you have to do is create conditions where this engagement and innovation is possible. I'm fortunate I'm trying to give you a reference point. For me, Syracuse has been a great environment where they've allowed these opportunities, encouraged it, and supported it. So if I come up with a crazy idea, they'll help me, you know, do that, an experiment or, you know, an industry partnership. They're very supportive of that. So that's certainly that. But certainly this idea of sharing ownership. So the students have ownership in it, getting your colleagues and other people building that relationship. So one of the collaborations that we've done with the industry that I is kind of innovative is it, and it was directly to, I don't know how many were at the conference before where they were talking about certification or accreditation. Okay. So we worked, we're in a beta test right now. How many know what Hootsuite is here or use Hootsuite? So some of you, okay. So Hootsuite is a social media dashboard that allows you to use multiple different social media platforms in one window or one space. And so it's a pretty popular tool. They're a company based out of Vancouver. We partnered with them. They have Hootsuite University. So they've had to train professionals who need to use these in their companies. So they developed a suite of training tools, exams, and other things that we've incorporated in our class. So with Hootsuite, the students actually get access to a Hootsuite Pro account, the same ones that they would use in their professional life. They go through certification, so when they leave, they have Hootsuite certification. They're then added to a directory of social media consultants by geography. If so, somebody's looking for somebody with those skill sets, they'll find the students from this beta test that we're doing, and they also get a stamp of certification onto their blog. Now, it's sort of the question: well, does that mean they don't need to go to university anymore if they just get that Hootsuite certification? And I think the answer is no. Those higher level concepts that we talked about are still important to be delivered in a education environment. So that combination is something that's very different in terms of what industry and higher ed are doing. And one of the things that panel before was grappling with is how do you, you know, do that certification? And again, probably the biggest resistance to these type of ideas are a culture shift of, you know, kind of sharing that. And one of the things that social media, if you had said before, you know, the criticism would be higher ed is an ivory tower. Well, that ivory tower has opened doors now through digital and social. Anybody can come into that environment, that learning environment. The walls aren't there anymore with these tools. Another innovative program. This one is, I think this is the first time it's been announced. It hasn't been officially launched yet, so you guys are hearing about it for the first time. Is a college pilot program with LinkedIn. So we've partnered, Syracuse University is going to be part of the college pilot program with LinkedIn. We're one of 10 universities in a beta test with them where we'll be trying, working with them on all their new platforms and revisions. We'll try them out and we'll be able to help our alumni, our students and other people, students and faculty to use these tools and see how they can use them in their own career paths and education tracks. And hopefully the goal, I might be slightly off of these numbers, but it's something like 4 U.S. universities and 6 international or 6 international, you know, some combination of that, of these 10. And, so again, you say, well, you know, LinkedIn, if they're only partnering 10, what can that do for me? I'm hoping it gives you the idea, if you're a startup or a VC firm, of how you might partner with the higher ed one. If you have a platform that you want people to, you know, try to use or your platform have some traction, you might be able to partner up in a pilot program. So it's about the learning experience and the testing of this, not, you know, the sales of that. So it's a mistake if you're an entrepreneur or a VC company. It's like, oh, I'm going to go to higher ed because I'm going to sell the students and get them to try out my new, you know, get them to buy my app. And if you go in thinking of the students as a market, you'll probably be marched right off campus if you do that. But if you pursue a learning experience and incorporate that. So if you're a startup and you want to work with classes on how they can learn about what it's like to be a startup and what it takes to be a startup and how that process works and the learning aspect of it, then, you know, maybe you have a way to incorporate that into it. So those are two. Another example of a partnership. So this gap between the students that are being delivered to the business environment and what education is preparing them for, many companies are being forced to create their own training because people aren't coming in with the qualifications that they need. So they're recognizing that and then doing that not only to retrain their own employees on some of these concepts, but also to train the ones that are coming in, you know, fresh from college. An innovative example is 360i, which is a digital agency. They have 360iU, which is their internal training program. 360i, the agency itself, actually is partnered up with Newhouse and the advertising department, and they've actually invested money into this program. I'm pretty sure that's public record in terms of the information that's out there, but they invested $100,000 into this concept where students at Newhouse will receive fellowship money that will allow them to travel to spend time at this digital agency and learn from them directly. The digital agency then comes onto campus and spends time with our students, and that's much more of a deeper learning experience. So you can almost say it's a form beyond internship to that level of apprenticeship. And so that's sort of a different or innovative approach or partnership. And again, you know, for the group that was up here before, I think all their solutions, at least to my understanding, were about, you know, the money that they were going to make in this process. And I think the opportunity is, you know, to be more creative and say, well, how can we partner up that benefits both people and use funds that are already there, resources that are there, rather than adding, you know, more cost into the system. Another example of an innovation that we're doing at Syracuse and with Newhouse, Ketchum is a PR agency. Mindfire is a crowdsourcing tool that they've created. This one is about open innovation. This idea that they'll present a problem out there, students can go in and share their ideas. The crowd then has a say in what those best ideas are as they, you know, rise up in credibility and popularity. And those best ideas are then rewarded monetarily. And so this is a educational tool and crowdsourcing. So they get direct experience in it. And again, it's a way for people to share ideas. And there's plenty of examples in the, you know, whether it's a Kickstarter or other ones that are using that sort of open innovation, crowdsource model of sharing and connecting. So I think that's another example. Again, I'm hoping for those of you in the entrepreneurial space or VC space, that's giving you some ideas on how you might approach higher ed and how you might model this. And for those of you in higher ed, I'm hoping some of these are maybe getting you ideas on what you might do in your own space with your own local startups and local VC community. Another example. We also are looking at, you know, one of the areas that's very interesting in this space of how do we make sense, how do we find, filter, and organize all the information that's out there. So curation has become very interesting. One of the companies that we're working with is Pearl Trees. It's a European, French-based company, I believe. They're actually partnering us with us on a curation tool. We're going to be doing a beta test with a new mobile application where students will try out this mobile application before it's released to the public. They'll be able to give feedback, so there's a learning experience, and then based on that feedback, Pearl Trees can refine their product. So it's a learning experience, and at the core of it, they're actually learning about this idea of finding, filtering, and organizing information. But it's also a very innovative partnership as well. So that would be another example of what we're doing. So I guess what I'm trying to imply that I'm hoping I'm making a case for is that really encouraging participation and collaboration, inviting people in, you know, with these things, setting some objectives, you know, measurements, incentives, and rewards for these in terms of how you measure these. So there's some just sort of quick things. But really what I want to encourage people is don't be afraid to get involved. You know, be brave, be bold. Approach those people in higher ed, the professors, the administrators, those people. And don't be discouraged. You may find somebody who's not receptive to it, and that's okay. Then, you know, try to find somebody that will be receptive to it. Don't take that as the end of the conversation. That just means that that person isn't open yet to some of these ideas. So I'd really like to encourage you to do that. For those of you in higher ed, I know I skipped over a lot in terms of this culture shift and what it takes to get, you know, an organization on board. Businesses are struggling with this too, but, you know, my goal is to say, well, what's next after you, you know, get past that struggle and have this underway? What was sort of next with that? I just like to finish and then we'll open up for questions. Things are changing so quickly, so keep calm. Nobody else knows what they're doing either because we're all learning. I mean, you know, Pinterest is a new tool. People are just it's a very recent discovery. They're, you know, now they're learning about it. Before that, people didn't have the answer. So we're all learning together, so that's okay. At the same time, some people know more than you, so listen to those people. Good advice from the most interesting man in the world. So there's a little paradox there, right? We're all learning together, but then some people do have some experience. But it's very divergent in terms of what those experience might be. So I think I'd like to open it up for questions, and then I'll leave just a little bit at the end for one, you know, final note or word of encouragement or advice that I always end. If you is this being recorded? Should they? Yeah. Would you prefer they come down to the microphone, or you'll bring it around? Okay. Could you? Sorry, they're recording it. So if you can come down to the microphone.
My question is, you brought it up at the end. What are some ideas or opportunities you think higher education institutions have on Pinterest?
Yeah, I mean, Pinterest is a great visual curation tool. It allows people to organize content and information in a visual way. And I think one of the things that's you know, beneficial about it is it's a pretty simple, you know, concept to learn in terms of how to use it. This idea of, like, you know, we used to put stuff on the refrigerator, right, to a note on the refrigerator. It's that same idea of pinning it to a board. So that simple concept makes it very sort of easy and quick to adopt in terms of people to understand. I think some other curation tools are more robust in terms of their organizational capabilities and other aspects. So it'll be interesting to see how Pinterest evolves. But I think higher ed, you know, they could have everything from photos on campus of events going on, different aspects of programming that's available. They could have, you know, all the different schools and organizations could have photos that would be shared. It could be organized. So if you were interested in, football. There's, you know, probably sports photos around the football team that could be on Pinterest and et cetera. So those might be ways. And the again, behind Pinterest, you can add in backlinks, and it could link to, you know, an application or some other follow-up communication or a resource that people could use. So it could be used for, you know, just informational purposes, follow-up recruiting purposes, transactional eventually. They're trying to use it where, you know, you could actually, you know, maybe you're going to sell university t-shirts and books through Pinterest if people click on it. They're ways away from that e-commerce model, but that's sort of a future deliverable on that, I think. So, yeah, good question. Hope that helped.
Hello. I've been reading Susan Cain's book, Quiet, which I believe has some very important implications for how we structure education. So what are your thoughts on how we organize collaboration, but also allow for quiet spaces for innovation?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, I think especially at a conference like this, you know, we probably already, all of us felt overwhelmed, information overload, conversation overload with all the collaboration and energy and, you know, the adrenaline rush. And then after that goes away, you know, all of those aspects, I think, are true in that digital environment. So when they're high engaged. So, yeah, that time for contemplation and carving that out. I attended a few entrepreneurship conferences, and many of the entrepreneurs will tell you that that's a really important aspect, is to make sure that you carve out time in your schedule to just think. And that just because you have an opening in your schedule doesn't mean you need to fill it with meetings. So I think that's really important. I also think, and we do some of this in class, so I don't want to give the impression that we're all online all the time. There still is traditional engagement, face-to-face engagement. But one of the things that that we've done, and again, kind of modeling what's going on in that world, a couple of things that we do is we'll have like topless meetings, we call that, where you no laptop, check your phone at the door. Everybody actually has to come in and set everything down, because here, this is probably, you've had this at South, you know, we're all doing this, and or you're talking to somebody and they're, you know, they're looking out and tweeting and you're talking to them. So we have that. So topless meetings are one way where you check your technology, but at the same time you have to be respectful of people's time. And in terms of what they're going to do with that. So that might be quiet time or, you know, discussion time that's more face-to-face and productive. So one of the things we do is we actually have standing meetings. When I meet with a team of students, we'll stand around and talk, and they don't have time to get when you're standing, you kind of have to be a little more focused. If you sit down and turn your computer on, you can kind of check out. So we do some of those things with topless meetings and standing meetings. I've also heard of ones where people have this might not be to your quiet time, but they'll actually have like a ball or a football or something, and basically as people are talking, they're throwing it around to the next person who's going to be part of that conversation, kind of the ping pong aspect of conversation that sometimes doesn't happen. And so if you're not focused and paying attention to the conversation, you could get hit in the side of the head with the ball. So it does make you stay, you know, focused. And I also know some people, and the same, you know, may seem a little, catchy, but they might have a yellow flag, like warning, you're kind of going on and on and not really getting anywhere. So people can hold up a little sign that says, hey, this is kind of not really productive anymore. And so, you know, people are doing some of that and kind of going back to that. So somewhere in there's that balance. So there still is value to that. Good question. Any other questions? Oh, thank you.
So I thank you for this talk.
And thank you.
I know that in corporations particularly, there's a lot of times sort of a wall between people because we're coworkers, so we don't share our deepest, most intimate. And a lot of times the community doesn't really exist. You can almost be close with strangers than you can in some corporations. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering do you have any recommendations for any of these social media platforms that you think would be the best, that might break down some of the walls between corporations and actually help create community and collaboration between people in those environments?
Well, no, that's a good question. And I think in terms of that idea of community, I don't really want – I hope I've not discounted the importance of face-to-face. So I say the best, you know, we're all here for face-to-face communication, for this firsthand learning experience. That's critical. And so, you know, if you can start there, you know, that's the best place to start. And then if you can continue it online, as many of us will do here as we, you know, connect, then that starts to build it. But if there is no face-to-face to start with, then, you know, I wouldn't say there's one best. I think I would find out where people are already at. So if they're on LinkedIn, if they're on Facebook, if they're on Twitter already and within your organization and they're already there, how can you connect them where they're already at? Then rather than saying, oh, we're all going to go on to whatever the next new shiny platform, and that's where we're going to create it. And that's where I'm a little worried in the education space. They're already designing, you know, a bunch of new platforms where we're already going to go to and try to create a whole other community when the communities already exist in many of these places. And I know there's some aspects of policy related to this, training and even the banning of some of these things. But, you know, I think we can figure that part out. I think that'd be more important than just keep building more and more of these that have to be going through this whole procurement process and add all kinds of new costs into the system. I think we can harness the fundamentals that are already there and build upon them, especially with the API or the applications that are available that are, you know, open where other people can connect to them. You know, those are built on existing platforms, and so that kind of infrastructure is there. And I don't know, for those of you in higher ed, in Blackboard, you know, there was someone on a panel, and you know, Blackboard is a course management tool, but it's a very un-user-friendly tool, and it's not connected to the internet. Only recently did they finally open it up, and quite frankly, myself and many people I know have just don't use that course management tool. They use a lot of other, you know, free, easier to use, socially enabled tools that actually can help a student in terms of their career and skill sets that they need to get a job. And so I feel like, you know, Blackboard is maybe late to that. And maybe that control, that command and control model will, you know, impose itself on it, and that will become, you know, that has still viability. But I don't know. I haven't used it in years because there's so many other better ways to engage with students and share content information using all these other tools that the business world is using. The business world isn't using Blackboard. Yeah.
I really had more of a comment
sure.
on behalf of Dr. Ward than a question. I represent PearlTrees, which is one of their industry partners. And if you are interested in working with companies, you need to do what he did, which is become a super user of a product. The reason why we discovered his classes and became involved with his university was because he is a super user of almost every social media product that he teaches. He is so prolific in his use of these products that if you work for a company with one of the products that he's using, you can't help but notice his efforts, and then by default notice the spread of his efforts through his students. It was really a powerful example of how a single person can disseminate a broad message and become attractive to a corporation who then wants to learn from the professor and the students. And so I think as you know, learning and teaching professionals, one of the most important takeaways, which maybe he didn't emphasize enough because he's a pretty humble guy, is you got to eat your own dog food. You really need to use these products and use them super effectively. I mean, I have to study curation products for a living, and yet when I wanted to really understand Pinterest, which is a major competitor of ours, I didn't until I saw how he used it. And so I think that's a very important take home is if you're going to get your students really indoctrinated into understanding these tools, you got to use them really well yourself. And secondly, one tool which you might look at, which does cost money, but we're testing out right now in a company I'm consulting for is Jive, and it's amazing. It's not public, so it would let you break down walls within your corporation without the fear of people sort of exposing themselves externally.
All right, thank you. Any other questions? All right. I'd just like to end with one last thing. It's something I always do. It's I don't know if you want to call it a tradition, but this is one I always leave. Oops, did this time. This is one that a message that I always leave the students with. Just a sec. Sorry about that. It was queued up just a second ago. So this is the best advice that I could ever give any of you from the most interesting man in the world.
Find out what it is in life that you don't do well, and then don't do that.
All right. Stay thirsty, my friends. Keep digging for worms. Thank you. Thanks.